Happy April Fool's Day, listeners, and welcome to another outstanding episode of FW Presents, the epitome of a mixed bag and a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Ryan Daly, but don't worry, you only have to suffer my voice for this introduction. For most of this episode, you get to hear the vastly more delightful voice of our fallen comrade, the late, great Zoom Yukinori. Today is April 1st. In the United States, this is a religious holiday called April Fool's Day, where we celebrate the biblical story of God asking Abraham to sacrifice his son as a prank. We honor this tradition by playing jokes on each other, telling lies, trying to make our friends look foolish in some way. In the past, the Fire and Water Podcast Network has produced April Fool's Day episodes of fake podcasts, like a random Indiana Jones podcast played completely straight as if it was a regular feature on the network. That was originally going to be the theme for this year, too. You almost got to hear a random episode of Showgirls Minute. I was going to watch one of the more sexually explicit minutes of that horrendous movie and discuss it in painful detail with my mother. Just think, there is a parallel timeline where you got to listen to that. But earlier this year, I discovered something kind of cool. Today, April 1st, 2021, is the 90th anniversary of the first publication of The Shadow Magazine. I am referring, of course, to the iconic character, The Shadow, created, more or less, by Walter Gibson. The Shadow has appeared in pulp magazines, radio dramas, comic books and strips, TV series, and movies. You know the tagline. Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow knows. You know what he looks like, dressed all in black with a cape or trench coat, a wide-brimmed hat, a red scarf covering his mouth but not fully covering his angular nose, definitely not COVID-safe, and two pistols in his hands. One of the classic literary pulp characters like Zorro, the Phantom, and the Green Hornet. I wanted to do something special for his 90th anniversary. One of the first thoughts I had was covering the Shadow's appearances alongside the Dark Knight Detective in the Batman comic books written by Denny O'Neil, which you can hear Chris Franklin and I discuss on tomorrow's episode of Batman Nightcast. But while I was thinking of those Shadow and Batman connections, I recalled a curious story that appeared in Detective Comics 500. It's a prose story called The Batman Encounters Grayface, written by the Shadow's creator Walter Gibson. I reread that story, and I was struck by how much it felt like a Shadow story, and how much it didn't really feel like a Batman story. So it came as no surprise at all when I did a little research and confirmed that, yep, Gibson took an unpublished Shadow story and reworked it very superficially to make it a Batman story. Like I said, it's kind of a funny curiosity because it serves as a Batman story and a Shadow story, and also neither. After settling on this idea, I reached out to Adrian Zett, who has been doing a lot of the post-production work on Zoom Yukinori's podcast since Zoom passed away more than a year ago. I knew that Zoom recorded himself reading a bunch of DC prose stories, so I asked Adrian if there was any chance he recorded The Batman Confronts Grayface. And of course he did, because that was Zoom. So, that is what you're going to hear this episode. Zoom Yukinori's dramatic reading of The Batman Confronts Grayface, written by Walter Gibson. The story also featured select illustrations by Tom Yates, and you can see samples of that art at the website fireandwaterpodcast.com. I want to give extra special thanks to Adrian Zett and Zoom's son Isamu Yukinori for mixing and editing this piece. Tomorrow, you get to hear me and Chris Franklin talk about The Shadow in even more detail as we discuss Batman issues 253 and 259. This is our 90th anniversary tribute to such an iconic character. All right, I will shut up now. Ladies and gentlemen, Zoom Yukinori.
The Batman Encounters Grayface by Walter Gibson. Originally published by DC Comics Incorporated in Detective Comics Volume 1, Issue 500, March 1981. Read by Zoom Yukinori. When Herbert Garland opened his eyes, he stared in utter disbelief at the man across the desk. He was studying fixed features that were as smooth as parchment, and the hue of dried ashes, with a broad, lipless mouth and sharp but beady eyes that glittered through narrowed lids. Garland greeted that sight with a gasp of recognition.
Levisazgri!
A crackly laugh was the other man's response. Then, with scarcely a motion of his straight-slitted mouth, he stated in the same sharp tone,
"Here in America, they call me Grayface."
Garland gave a knowing nod that brought new throbs to the back of his aching head. Still wondering how he had arrived here, he leaned back and glanced at his surroundings. Like Grayface, he was seated in a teak wood chair amid garish oriental decorations, and Grayface was wearing an oriental robe to match. There were three more men in the room, all in Malayan costumes, one smooth-shaven, the other two with heavy beards. Behind Grayface was a curtain that he lifted to disclose a wall safe. Opening it, he removed a small jewel case, which he placed upon the desk.
"I am also the keeper of the Blue Pearl," crackled Grayface. "So for those who seek it, like yourself, I offer a fair and simple challenge."
He turned to the smooth-shaven man and ordered,
"Klon, bring the hourglass."
Klon went to a corner closet and brought back a large hourglass with its lower section filled with sand. Meanwhile, the bearded men picked up a long coil of rope and began spreading it between them. Garland's eyes, however, were focused on the jewel box as Grayface opened it and brought out a gleaming pearl, the size of a large marble, that flashed a bluish iridescence as he held it to the light.
"You will be tied with the coil of rope,"
Grayface told Garland,
"and the hourglass will be turned over. When the last grain of falling sand marks the end of the hour, the Blue Pearl will be yours, if you have freed yourself. If not..."
By then, the bearded men were approaching Garland with the rope, and the eager glint in their eyes was all the warning Garland needed. He realized that once those strangling coils were tightened around his neck, he could never hope to wrest himself from their tenuous grip. Frantically, he appealed to Grayface.
"The pearl is yours. Keep it. All I ask is freedom. Freedom to go my way."
Rising from the table, Grayface waved for the bearded men to drop the rope and bring Garland along with them. Gripping his arms in an iron clutch, they did. At the door, Grayface paused to give an order to Klon, who was still beside the desk.
"Lock the pearl and its case inside the safe,"
came the crackly command,
"and put the hourglass back on its shelf. Then join us at the Dragon Room."
At the end of a hallway, Grayface opened a door to reveal a room hung with black drapes ornamented with golden dragons of various sizes and fanciful shapes, backed by paneled walls. The room was dimly lit by candles set in high brackets, and the fragrance of an exotic perfume pervaded the atmosphere. As the bearded men thrust Garland into the room, turning him so he faced the door, Grayface spoke in an almost kindly tone.
"Rest here a while and forget the Blue Pearl. When you are ready to leave, try the wall panels until you find one that will open.
With that, Grayface stepped back with his two followers, and Garland saw Klon's face peer over the shoulders of the bearded men as he rejoined the group. Then the door closed, and Herbert Garland was alone, lulled by the quiet and the flickering candlelight, but not for long. As moments passed, Garland noted that a figure of a dragon seemed to waver with the light. Then, as time itself began to slacken, other figures stirred in the same fashion. Garland clutched the folds of a curtain shifting behind him and felt the scale of an embroidered dragon press against his neck. He turned, thrust the curtain away, and as he did, another swung his way, bringing him within reach of a dragon's claws. Hissing sounds followed as he met a dragon face to face. Whether real or imaginary, the dragons roused Garland to a pitch of frenzy. With curtains falling as he tugged them, Garland felt the dragons coiling around him, and he burrowed deeper to escape their clutching claws and ferocious fangs. He was choking, stifling, suffocating, while his ears rang with a horrendous hissing that ended when he blacked out completely, and a thick silence of doom settled within the room of terror. Chinatown was aglow, a galaxy of brilliance that spread its glittering tentacles through the surrounding areas of huge Gotham City. Old buildings of assorted shapes and sizes mingled among the new, so the glare gave way to patches of darkness cast by yawning doorways and occasional alleys. Flitting from one oasis of doom to another was a figure more fantastic than any of the grotesque statues that leered from the windows of curio shops. Even the living phantom's face was obscured by a lowered hood that terminated in a mask to match the tight-fitting garb of darkish material that clad the limber figure. And whenever the moving shape reached a stretch where light and shadows mingled, it literally weaved itself into the background like a creature from a dream. There were moments, though, when the mysterious stranger paused in full view. On one occasion, a stolid Chinese shopkeeper, standing by his doorway, stared suddenly and blinked his eyes in startled disbelief, only to wonder if he had really seen what he thought he had. Again, a stroller, gazing across the street, gripped the arm of a man who was walking with him and gasped, "Look, over there, the Batman!" By the time the other stroller looked, the cape's shape merged with the blackness of an alleyway, and the only other person who might have glimpsed it was the driver of a magnificent limousine that was nosing toward the heart of Chinatown. The driver, a slim man sitting bolt upright with a British spine bred true over generations serving as gentleman's gentleman, gave his horn a warning toot that was really an acknowledgement, for he turned right on the next corner and doubled back to pause at the other end of the dark alley. There, the Batman slid unseen into the big car. When the limousine stopped again, its passenger emerged in the person of Bruce Wayne, a wealthy Gothamite who was wearing a tuxedo and carrying a topcoat and a cane, as though he had just come from some formal affair. Wayne's fastidious attire and his leisurely manner were in utter contrast to the Batman's sleek garb and elusive stride. Nonchalantly, he noted a doorway marked Yangxing Cafe. He entered there and went up a stairway and joined two men at a table in a secluded corner. One was Police Commissioner Gordon, the other a Chinese merchant whom the commissioner introduced as Ling Kuang, and asked to proceed with his discussion.
"There are rumors that a dangerous man called Grayface is here in Chinatown," declared Kuang, "firmly established in a forgotten stronghold used in the gang wars of many years ago. He calls himself Grayface in a dozen different languages, for his real nationality is unknown. He operates off the coast of Southeast Asia, dealing in piracy and plunder."
"And what is his purpose here?" inquired Wayne. "To demand funds from respectable Chinese merchants like Ling Kuang here," put in Commissioner Gordon indignantly, "along with honest American importers and shipowners who bring in goods from the Orient."
"And word has spread," added Kuang, "that he can be contacted through secret agents stationed here in Chinatown, especially around the Far East Bazaar, which is often quite crowded."
"And did many respond?" asked Wayne. "Quite a few," nodded Kuang.
"Really, to protect themselves, we had watchers who saw them come and go. No contact."
"The same applied to American importers," added Gordon. "We had detectives checking to see if they responded to the offer. A few did, but with no result."
Bruce Wayne seemed puzzled.
"And why not?"
"I blame the Batman," replied Kuang. "Some of our watchers spotted him, or thought they did, moving around as if he knew about Grayface. Maybe he scared Grayface's men away."
"Or perhaps," observed Wayne, "the Batman might have been trying to draw Grayface's agents along his own trail to find out where he fitted into the picture. He could then have reversed the trail and followed them."
That brought an understanding nod from Ling Kuang, although he did not realize that Bruce Wayne was actually telling him what the Batman really had in mind. As for Commissioner Gordon, he missed the point entirely.
"Forget the Batman," said Gordon. "What we want from you, Bruce, is a list of people we may have overlooked, so that we can warn them. Can you help us?"
Bruce Wayne agreed that he could. So while Gordon and Kuang were discussing other details, he went to a phone booth and made a call to the towering headquarters of Wayne Enterprises, instructing Lucius Fox, his chief operating officer, to put the required data through their huge computer. Returning to the table, he rejoined Gordon and Kuang in a chat, which ended when the commissioner made a phone call of his own to police headquarters.
"Nothing important there," declared Gordon, emerging from the booth. "They're so stirred up by this talk of Grayface that anything trivial seems important. A few hours ago, the River Patrol surprised three men about to dump a body from a pier of the Indonesian line. Two men fled, but the third tried to shoot it out and they clipped him when he dived from the end of the pier and probably drowned."
Wayne put in a casual query. "What about the victim?"
"He was still alive," replied Gordon. "When the ambulance crew revived him, he became incoherent, so they took him to Gotham Hospital, where he began screaming about sea serpents. The doctors put him in isolation, and they say he might be able to talk a few days from now, if ever."
Finishing that summary, the commissioner added,
"I have my official car here. Can I drop you at your building, Bruce?"
"No, no," replied Wayne. "Alfred is here with the rolls. Thanks just the same, commissioner."
The limousine nosed up as Wayne and Gordon emerged from the entrance of the Yangxing. Bruce Wayne stepped into the big car and it pulled away, but the destination that he gave was not that of the towering Wayne Foundation.
"Take me to Gotham Hospital, Alfred. Stop at the side door of the psychiatric wing, the one that says staff only."
Thank you.
In a dimly lighted room at the hospital, Herbert Garland was staring upward at the dull white ceiling, forming fanciful shapes from things that weren't even there, and muttering about slimy snakes and scaly dragons. As his eyes went shut, he suddenly screeched,
"That face! Take it away!"
As his hand clawed wildly and his head sank back upon the pillows of his cot. Then, as his paroxysm subsided, his eyes opened wide and his entire body stiffened as he met the close-range gaze of a stranger whose face was masked from brow to lips by a cowl extending down from his forehead. Burning eyes bored from slits in the mask, straight lips were motionless, until Garland gasped,
"Qui êtes-vous? Who are you?"
Then the lips spoke a calm but firm reply.
"Un ami, a friend. They call me the Batman. And your name is?"
Herbert Garland. I come from the New Hebrides Islands, where I was brought up to speak both French and English."
By now, Garland was viewing his caped visitor more fully, and a strange sense of security was clearing his mind of the void that had engulfed it.
"I was a seaman on the freighter Malabar of the Indonesian line, bringing a special message for Blair Gonsett, the owner of the company. But I never delivered it. Something happened after the Malabar docked and I came ashore."
Garland's right hand went to the back of his head as an automatic recollection of a knockout blow. Anyone but the Batman might have ended the quiz right then, since circumstances indicated that he had been slugged shortly before the police found him unconscious on the pier. But Garland's garbled talk, particularly his references to slimy snakes and scaly dragons, pointed to a definite time lapse, in which Garland had suffered an experience so traumatic that a permanent memory block had resulted. Permanent, unless the Batman could jolt it loose, which he did. Clamping Garland's shoulders with both hands, the Batman brought his body erect and met him eye to eye with a boring gaze that brought a complete response as the Batman intoned,
"You have heard of Greyface?"
"Le visage gris. Oui, yes."
"And you have met him?"
Calmly, emphatically, the Batman drove home his words as a statement, not a query.
"Tell me where, when, and how."
A pause. Then,
"Tell me all."
That final phrase settled it. Garland told all. And no wonder. Looking into the Batman's glowing eyes, he recalled the grim gaze that had overpowered him on his last awakening. It all came back so vividly that Herbert Garland recited it detail for detail, item for item, without a falter. All the while he stared steadily into the Batman's inquiring eyes, sensing that their friendliness was drawing out the poison instilled by the enmity of Greyface. And all that time, the Batman was recording Garland's statements, including the parts played by Clawn and the Bearded Men, on a cassette that he carried in his well-equipped utility belt. When Herbert Garland finished, the Batman relaxed pressure on his shoulders and let him subside into a comfortable slumber. Leaving the room, the Batman passed a desk where one nurse was talking to another, both too occupied to note that he was passing by. "You know that new nut in room 15? One said. "I heard him talking just like somebody was listening to all he said." "They all get that way," the other nurse replied. "Sometimes I think they're goofier than the doctors." An hour later, Bruce Wayne, no longer the Batman, was listening to the computerized report in his penthouse suite.
It included Blair Gownsett in the list, with photographs of all persons named. With Gownsett's data was a notation that the shipowner was absent from New York and had left no word regarding where to reach him. Obviously, Grayface had intercepted the confidential letter intended for Gownsett by having Garland slugged and brought to his lair, then later dumped, apparently dead, back on the pier. So the only way to warn Gownsett of the impending danger was by watching for him in Chinatown, in case he came there hoping to find Grayface and try to make terms with him. The same rule applied, in lesser degree, to others on the computer list. So Bruce Wayne spent the next three evenings strolling about Chinatown. Not as the Batman, but as himself. Wayne had a whole crew of helpers, although they didn't realize it. During the first evening, he had spotted a dozen Chinese watchers who had obviously been supplied by Ling Kuang, plus another dozen headquarters men detailed by Commissioner Gordon. All were so busy screening people who resembled the computer photographs that they scarcely noticed a casual stroller like Wayne. They were particularly eager, these watchers, because this evening was the start of the Chinese New Year, and by midnight, the streets would be too crowded to trail anyone. Amid this tension, it was Bruce Wayne who spotted a heavy-set, pompous man whose roundish, ruddy face had roving eyes and thick lips that wore an indulgent smile as he strolled through the Far East Bazaar. Caught in that particular mood, his features were a perfect match for the photo of Blair Gownsett. Confident that other watchers would spot the shipowner, Wayne slipped into the darkness and soon emerged as the Batman. By a roundabout route, he easily spotted straggling watchers who were trailing Gownsett from one shop to another. By the time the trail reached the outskirts of Chinatown, the last few stragglers gave up, deciding that Gownsett was beyond chance of contact with Grayface and was probably intending to pick up a parked car or look for a cruising taxicab. So only the Batman was on the trail that led along a quiet street, until Gownsett suddenly turned into a wide but dimly lighted entrance that bore a sign, Pizza Palace. Easing in through a storeroom window, the Batman peered into a dining room and recognized it as a once popular Italian restaurant that had moved uptown a few years before. A few steps up was a darkened dining terrace that skirted the main floor, so the Batman promptly merged with its gloom and made a half circuit of the big room while he studied the few pizza patrons to see if Gownsett had joined any of them. There was no trace of the shipowner, nor where he could have gone, until the Batman reached an open archway at the rear of the place and looked into a secluded private dining room, a relic of an elegant era, with a marble fountain set in an alcove. Circling to the rear of the alcove, the Batman sat down on a marble bench, where he was well concealed by the fountain spray while he studied the tapestried walls, looking for an exit that Gownsett might have taken. There was none. Yet this was the one place where Gownsett must have gone to elude anyone who had been trailing him. Minutes passed while the Batman listened to the melodic tinkling of the fountain as its spray was gathered by a marble bowl surmounted on an ornate pedestal. Through the Batman's ever-active yet equally receptive mind strummed a theme that he recalled from somewhere past. Three coins in the fountain, three coins in the fountain. Whether a play, a song, a parable, or whatever else, it called for a response,
which the Batman provided by drawing 3 coins from a belt pocket and tossing them singly into the marble bowl, where the water's soft tinkle formed an accompaniment to their sharp clank. As the water swirled the 3 coins down the drain, a mechanism in the pedestal reacted like an automatic toll booth on a turnpike. Smoothly, steadily, the entire fountain slid forward with only a slight waver in its spray, revealing a square gap in the floor, with a steep stairway leading down to a lighted corridor beneath. Instantly, the Batman went down the stairway, not worrying when he heard the pedestal slide back, fountain and all, announcing that there was no chance of retreat. Blair Gownsett must have taken this route knowingly, so the Batman had taken it willingly, since he had guessed and duplicated the actions of the man who had gone before. But from now on, the Batman would be strictly on his own. What had been an invitation for Blair Gownsett would become a series of snares for him, thanks to a creature called Grayface. For a long while, the Batman followed a series of amazing passages that he recognized as unfinished subways, abandoned water systems, uncompleted pipelines, and many more questionable projects of the past which Grayface had hooked up to provide a route from outside Chinatown to lead into his inside lair. The Batman's sense of direction and distance, aided only by a simple compass, showed that he was near the center of Chinatown. In short, the way to find Grayface was from the outside in, not the inside out. Coming up some stone steps, the Batman found himself in an old storage room, where an opening in the wall marked a connecting entry to another building. As he moved into the vestibule, the Batman heard a sharp click behind him, but instead of turning, he instinctively sprang straight through. When he did turn, he saw a steel door sliding across the opening in the wall of the building he had left, and a moment later, a similar door closed the wall in the building where he now stood. A steady thrum followed, marking the descent of an elevator, and when it ended, both doors slithered open. But now the floor of the vestibule was the top of an elevator, in which the Batman might have been permanently entombed had he gone down with it. That narrow escape caused the Batman to look for more booby traps, as he made his way through stacks of crates and boxes, sidestepping any in his path, instead of shoving them aside and getting a high voltage shock or a burst of toxic gas. There was a spiral staircase in the corner, leading up to the floor above, and the Batman studied it carefully for several minutes to make sure it wasn't rigged, then ascended the staircase rapidly, and reached a room that had a fairly long corridor leading from it. In contrast to the rattly spiral stairs, the corridor looked very safe indeed, particularly as it had a finely tufted carpet forming a 15-foot streamer that ran almost wall-to-wall. In fact, it looked so inviting that the Batman didn't trust it. Taking a full running start, the Batman cleared the entire length of the carpet with a broad jump of almost 20 feet. Midway in the jump, he must have intercepted a photoelectric beam of black light, because the stretch of carpet split directly across the middle, with both sections dropping downward to disclose a deep pit, studded with long, upright steel spikes. Having escaped that pitfall, the Batman watched while the halves of the long trap door came upward lazily and locked in place. Then he continued on his way, to learn what else Grayface might have in store for him. The next stop was a highly polished wall that looked as though it had a sliding panel,
which proved to be the case when the Batman probed it with his deft fingertips. When the panel slid open, he entered a dimly lighted room and was not at all perturbed when the panel closed behind him, for he already recognized the setting from its dark drapes embroidered with golden dragons that seemed to quiver in the flickery candlelight. This was the dragon room that Herbert Garland had described so vividly, and it was easy for the Batman to picture Garland going berserk and ripping down the curtains, until he was so nearly smothered that Klon and the bearded men had supposed him to be dead and had taken him to the pier and dumped him there. A peculiar fragrance from the burning candles added credence to Garland's story, for the Batman recognized it as a form of hashish, which could produce hallucinations of the sort that Garland had experienced. To avoid them himself, the Batman promptly snuffed out the candles and began probing the far wall until he found the sliding panel through which Garland had been thrust into the dragon room. Slightly dizzy, the Batman reeled into the lighted hallway leading to Grayface's office, and he was promptly flanked by the two bearded men, who popped from curtained alcoves and pinioned his arms in an iron grip. Though the Batman could have shaken off that double clutch, he preferred to act groggier than he was while his captors were piloting him along the hallway, for he knew exactly what to expect and was prepared to accept Grayface's terms. So he was planted unceremoniously in the teakwood chair opposite the robed man with the ashen features and the straight-set lips. His eyes, however, had a pleased gleam that Garland had not noted, since Grayface had reserved it for visitors of a higher status, most notably the Batman.
"I have been expecting you," came the crackly tone. "I have long felt that if I purposely let watchers pick up the trail of someone I invited here, you alone would have sense enough to stay with it after it went beyond the supposed limits of Chinatown. Of course, I was quite confident that you would become a victim of one of my ingenious pitfalls, but the fact that you eluded all of them pleases me all the more, as it enables me to propose a fair and simple challenge."
Turning to a hunchy, beady-eyed man, Grayface ordered,
"Haja, bring the hourglass."
The man blinked, puzzled, and Grayface recalled,
"I forgot that you are new here, Haja. It is in the corner closet."
Haja's presence proved that Klon was the man who went off the pier and drowned during the shootout, but there were more important things to think about. The bearded men produced the coil of rope, and Grayface offered the Batman the very terms he had given Garland, even gesturing to the wall safe, saying he kept the blue pearl there and the Batman would win it if he met the challenge. But in his case, there was no alternative. The bearded men marched the Batman to an isolated room, relieved him of his flowing cape, flattened him face down on the floor, and used their long coil of rope to truss him completely while Grayface watched. First, they bound his wrists behind his back, then tied his ankles, brought them to his wrists, and tied them all together, doubling his body backward. Next, they bound his arms to his body, then ran three loops around his neck, finally carrying the rope down to his legs, trussing them as well. Grayface then took the hourglass from Haja, inverted it on a table, and crackled to the Batman.
"Start now and watch the sand fall while you struggle."
Then, handing a brazen gong and hammer to Haja, Grayface pointed the hunchy man to a chair and ordered,
"Sit there, and when the last grain of sand has fallen, Strike the gong.
With that, Grayface strode from the room, followed by his bearded henchmen. By then, the Batman was working on the rope, testing it for slack, which every escape artist since Houdini has accepted as the vital factor in every form of rope release. But this tie literally had a reverse twist. Any attempt to gain slack one way would tighten the rope elsewhere. Most vulnerable were the neck loops. A mere stretch of the legs could tighten them to the point of strangulation, from which there would be no way to loosen them. In short, the purpose of this tie was to encourage the victim to strain himself to the brink of suicide. After curbing such tendencies for half an hour, the Batman decided that the only course was to inch one hand free so it could work elsewhere as needed. When he finally completed that slow-motion process, the sand in the upper half of the hourglass showed less than 10 minutes left. Taking a bold course, the Batman reached his hand to a neck loop, held his breath, and gave a long, hard tug. As the loop lengthened, the other two loops tightened, and he felt a rattle in his throat, while his face went purple and his head seemed about to burst. Grimly, he thrust the loop up past his chin and clear over his head, bringing his hand down to his throat so he could claw the other two ropes loose. His breath came back. His mind returned to normal as he stared at the hourglass and saw that the sand was still at the 10-minute mark. As he wondered how that could be, he noted that the sand was no longer running. He also saw that Haja was nodding, half asleep. But when the hunchy man opened his eyes and saw there was still sand in the glass, he promptly began to doze again. What a break this was for the Batman! Pulling at the second neck loop, he carried it over his head, temporarily choking himself until he could get at the third loop and pull it free as well. That gave him slack enough to stretch his arms, which in turn enabled him to wrench his wrists from his ankles and extend his numbed legs. Gradually, his other hand came free, but by then, he was really working on borrowed time, for it was well past the allotted hour when Haja suddenly opened his eyes wide and saw the clogged hourglass. Realizing that he wasn't to sound the gong until all the sand had fallen, Haja rushed from the room to tell Grayface that something strange had happened. By then, the Batman was in rapid action, ridding himself of the tangled rope and coming to his feet. On a sudden hunch, he grabbed the big hourglass, twisted its cap loose, and inverted it so the clogged sand from the upper section came down into his waiting hand. Just then, the two bearded men rushed into the room, each brandishing a wavy-bladed Malay sword. They expected the Batman to throw the hourglass at them. Instead, he simply held up something which stopped them short the moment they saw it. Between his thumb and forefinger, the Batman was displaying the priceless blue pearl, which was his by the terms of his escape, and marked him as their master instead of Grayface. The bearded men didn't ask how the Batman had gained his prize so soon. They lowered their swords, bowed in obedience, and followed him into the office where Haja was trying to explain what little he could. When the Batman held up the blue pearl, Grayface crackled indignantly.
"That bauble is a counterfeit. I have the real blue pearl. See for yourselves."
Turning to the wall safe, Grayface unlocked it and brought out the same jewel case that he had shown to Herbert Garland several nights before. But this time it was not for the benefit of a stranger, but to convince his own bearded henchmen that they were being duped by the Batman.
As they edged forward to see the real pearl for themselves, Grayface popped the case open under their very eyes. Then his own sharp gaze went suddenly blank. The jewel case was totally empty. Again, the bearded men turned to the Batman and bowed to him as their new master. One brought him his cape, and as he attached it to the base of the mask which had always stayed firmly over his eyes, his lips formed a smile that proved he knew all. Groping for the answer, Grayface gained it.
"I handed the jewel case to Klon," crackled Grayface, "and told him to put it in the safe when he put the hourglass in the closet. He must have taken the pearl from the case and dropped it in the top of the hourglass when he put it in the closet. Then he turned the hourglass over so the sand would come down and cover it. That's why the hourglass stopped running after we turned it over tonight. The pearl sank with the sand and finally clogged it."
A pause, and then Grayface added with contempt,
"Klon intended to come back and really steal it, but he never did."
That addendum was Grayface's great mistake. Until then, the bearded pair were ready to believe him, but when he denounced Klon, the man who had died for them during the shootout, the insult was too great. They drew their swords and were driving for Grayface, until he shrieked a plea to the Batman, who halted them.
"You are now the keeper of the pearl," acknowledged Grayface, his once sharp tone a quaver. "But I can offer you something more. That man I lured here tonight, Blair Gownsett, if I tell you where you can find him, alive and well, will you let me go free?"
The Batman spoke a single word. "Agreed." Drawing himself erect, Grayface raised his hands to his forehead and drew them down with a peeling action, letting his drab, parchment features spread into a roundish, ruddy, heavy-lipped countenance, while his oriental robe, dropping from his shoulders, revealed a gray flannel jacket, blue bow tie, and striped trousers. In both appearance and attire, the self-styled Grayface was none other than the millionaire shipowner who had strolled in and out of Chinatown that evening.
"The trail you followed," declared Gownsett, "was my own private route for coming in and out of here and changing my identity on the way. Now that the game is over, I can take a shorter way."
He turned to his one remaining servant and added,
"Haja, bring the Chinese devil costume. After that, you can take orders from the Batman."
While Haja was gone, Gownsett spread his gray jacket wide, showing a curved, elongated box strapped around his waist. In a cynical tone, he told the Batman,
"I am glad you stopped your new servants from attacking me. I happen to be a walking time bomb, so you are also wise to get rid of me. Any sudden jolt, a shot from a gun, might blow me up with everything close by, so you should be glad to see me leave."
Haja had arrived with the devil costume, a garish robe complete with slippers and mittens that resembled huge claws, with a huge head equipped with bulging eyes that rolled and ears that wiggled automatically. Blair Gownsett slid himself into the fantastic contrivance and clumped his way into a side room where he banged on a brick wall that slid apart so he could step into an outside alley, from which he waved a clawed farewell. From there on, his plan was so simple that he didn't have to tell it. The Chinese New Year was already underway. By joining the merrymakers, he would soon be lost amid the medley of fanciful costumery, from which he would emerge unnoticed to resume a career of international piracy on foreign shores, where even the Batman could never trace him. But such was not to be. Otherwise, the Batman would not have let him go. The early celebrators were having their fun when a figure emerged from an alley in a costume so elaborate that they thought it was something even funnier than their own. Only because of that, they began dancing around the newcomer, preventing him from joining a group of less conspicuous devils a short way up the street. Annoyed by such proximity, this fanciful devil began warding them back, which made it all the funnier. Finally, convinced that he meant it, they heeded his warning waves and scattered away. But one funmaker, just for the fun of it, lighted a string of oversized firecrackers and tossed them so they slid clear to the feet of the fantastic figure that was motioning the crowd away. The expected crackle, crackle, crack was drowned by a monstrous boom. Viewers reeled back at the sight of a blinding flash, a concussion that jarred them all briefly and left them staring at a gaping hole in the street that the coming New Year parade would have to zigzag to avoid. Back in the former headquarters of Greyface, listeners beside the open exit heard the blast that somehow all anticipated. The Batman, attired in his full regalia, gave a parting gesture to signify that all of his new followers could go their way, as Greyface had gone his, but with hopes for a better, happier future, with which they all agreed. After everyone else had departed, the Batman went to the deserted office, picked up the telephone, dialed the private number of Police Commissioner Gordon, and announced, "Final report on case of Greyface. Confidential details are as follows." The details included those already told.